I'd like to introduce our last speaker of the day, Robert Durin from Texas Instruments, who will speak on 50 years of scaling Jack Kilby's invention.
Thanks, Gloria. After hearing my friend Jim Hollenhorst give a wonderful, amusing talk, you know, I was sitting there thinking, wow, why didn't I throw in some more jokes into my talk? You know, that was so much fun. I guess I'm just too literal a guy. I don't know if it's the kind of physicist that I am or whatever, but when they asked me to talk about the history of laboratory research at Texas Instruments and particularly focus on a few things that I'd overlap with a little bit more, although it won't be entirely that, I sort of took them at their word. And so I hope that at least some of the examples I'm going to show you will have little stories in them that perhaps will offer an insight into not only the history, but some things that are still relevant today. I took advantage of the fact in thinking about, what part of TI research do I want to talk about? Well, obviously, I focused on semiconductors, not all of the many other things that TI has done over the years, like geophysical stuff work in the defense areas, radars, all of that. I did for sure wanted to focus on semiconductors, but I thought, gee, this just happens to be the 50th anniversary of Jack Kilby's invention of the integrated circuit. And so why don't I talk about that? And in particular, throw in examples that mostly have to do with how we've scaled, which is just the word we use in our industry for miniaturization, as we've gone forward. So, is this not working anymore? Oh, there we go. All right. So, I'll start with this chart from Ray Kurzweil, actually, that kind of gives a very long view of what's been happening in computing in general. Since about the beginning of the last century. And so you've got a graph here that shows what you can buy computing-wise in terms of operations per second for $1,000 versus time. And you can see we've been through an era of mechanical calculators, starting with the Babbage engine, I guess, and through electromechanical vacuum tubes, discrete transistors, and integrated circuits. And so that's obviously the part of it that I'm going to pick up with. And if you were here for the first talk, you heard a very nice introduction by Paul Horn to a lot of the issues that I'm going to talk about. And so I'm not going to talk about that in too much generality, but really try to focus on some of the details of what's been involved in the scaling of integrated circuits since Jack's invention. This is one of my favorite pictures of all time. Friend gave it to me a few years ago, and I think I missed this particular issue of Popular Mechanics in 1954. I did read some of them just about back then at my grandfather's house. Anyway, the gist of this is that Rand Corporation back in 1954 was saying that 50 years from then, in 2004, it would be possible to have a home computer, and they were guessing it would look something like this. Now, there's a few things that are mysterious to me in this. I can't imagine what this big steering wheel-looking thing has to do with anything. Of course, the television on the upper right, that's some kind of a monitor, right, and the teletype in front. But anyway, musing things in here, talking about how this will be probably too expensive for most people, but at least it'll be easy to program because you'll be using Fortran, and, it'll be, just a real wonderful thing to have in your house if you can afford it. Well, so what was wrong with this vision? The problem was, in 54, this was just 4 years before, Jack Kilby invented the integrated circuit, which really put us on a whole new era of how to miniaturize things. Now, this first very crude-looking device that Jack made only has one transistor in it and one capacitor and a few resistors. But the notion of the idea was that you could indeed combine those devices. The transistor is kind of centered here and the capacitor over here, and there's various resistors all in this one bar. This is actually germanium. He did a silicon one very shortly thereafter. But the fact that you could do all of those functions, the active switch, the capacitor, and the resistor all in one monolithic block of material was really the central idea. Now, there were other competing ideas that people had for miniaturization at that time. In fact, at Bell Labs that you've heard a lot from today, I think there were some people that were thinking, this isn't so great because that's a lousy resistor in there, a lousy capacitor. And so they were looking for more optimized individual components, whereas Jack was trying to look at a little bigger picture view and say, well, if you could do even sort of poor spec components in one monolithic slab, you might be able to scale that and make something out of it in the future. And indeed, that's what eventually happened. But as Jack himself told me several times, he and his colleagues who were working on this, they said were often the entertainment at many of the conferences that they went to back in those days trying to sell this idea that this was the way to go in electronics. So here, jumping forward many years, 42 years, I guess, are some of the 2000 Nobel laureates when they were honored in the White House. Whoops, I'm not very good at using this thing. Let's see. It's very jumpy, isn't it? Now I've gone.
Left one goes forward, right one goes back.
Right one goes back. So am I going? Yeah, here. Okay, good. So here is Jack Kilby on the far right, a very tall guy. He was about 6'7 or so. And I had the pleasure of having an office next to him at TI when he was a consultant for many, many years. And also had the pleasure of knowing Alan McDermott here, the New Zealander who worked on conductivity in polymers and got the Nobel Prize in chemistry that same year. Daggone it. Okay, here we go. So one of the challenges that Jack faced early on was actually trying to demonstrate to people that integrated circuits were really useful, that they really had some potential. And so one of the ideas that he had and worked on with Jerry Merriman is maybe we could make a little bitty calculator with this thing. I mean, something that, you know, we could say is basically handheld. So first they had to make a breadboard of it. You know, back then circuits needed to be tested. We didn't have the electronic design automation tools we did now. So essentially, with discrete components, this big mess here was that calculator, and they proved that that circuit worked, and then they had to put that into an integrated circuit, and this was 1966, so this was 8 years, actually, after the invention. But they succeeded at that time in putting that into the first handheld calculator. Now, am I going to get this right? No. Okay. Shortly thereafter, in the early 70s, some other fellows at TI, Michael Cochran and Gary Boone, came up with the idea of further integration as scaling allowed more and more transistors to be put on one chip. And they said, well, gee, you know, we're at the point now. We can put a read-only memory, which is this piece here, which can hold the program code, as well as random access memory and various kinds of control logic and the ALU to do the arithmetic, etc., all on one silicon chip. And so that was the first microcomputer chip. Actually, the picture here isn't the very first one, but it's one that came out shortly after that was marketed as the TMS-1000. Okay, a few years after that, another fellow, Harvey Cragen, came up with the idea that it would be very useful to have a specialized type of microcomputer, one that was programmable but did this digital signal processing function. And I can still remember asking one of my electrical engineer colleagues a number of years ago, well, what is a DSP anyway? I mean, what's so special about it? And he said, oh, it multiplies and then it adds up the sum of things that are multiplied together. So I said, oh, it evaluates a series. And so that's obviously very useful for a lot of things, especially filtering and that sort of thing and signal processing. And of course, is very instrumental in the development of cell phones and many other things. And it's been of great value to TI. But there's Harvey's original sketch and one of the early DSPs. Now, that history, which had to do with scaling and putting more functions on a single chip, I went from the level over that next 50 years of having the one transistor that Jack Kilby had on the voltage-controlled oscillator to over a billion that you can put on a single chip today. So quite an incredible advance. A few years ago, our CEO asked me to make some kind of a slide that would just kind of help him in a presentation to a mostly lay audience of what does that really mean, that factor of scaling that we've had over those 50 years. How could you visualize that? And so I made this slide, which said, okay, if you take one of our big chips today, which is about 2 centimeters on a side, and you imagined you could just magically blow that up by a linear factor of 1,000,000 on each side, then you would have an area that would be about the size of what you might call New York City. In other words, Manhattan Island is about 13 miles long, and it's about 20 kilometers, which is about 1,000,000 times, or is exactly 1,000,000 times 2 centimeters. And so you get this kind of comparison. Now, suppose you were to walk around this Manhattan landscape, but it being the magnified chip, you would be looking at a bunch of transistors all over the place, these little polysilicon gates that would, in the smallest feature sizes we have today, each be about 1 inch wide after you've multiplied it by the factor of 1,000,000. And the edges of those things would be specified to the nearest millimeter, which of course is a nanometer at this scale. So if you can imagine just a whole landscape like Manhattan Island and actually some of the surrounding boroughs where you've got all of these 1 inch wide things and their edges are all placed where they need to be, at least drawn to the nearest millimeter. They may be 1 millimeter off here and there, but they're drawn to that accuracy. That's basically what a modern integrated circuit looks like. If you looked at the wiring connecting those transistors together, it'd be about a quarter of a million miles long, and it would be stacked in 10 different levels. if you go and look at the actual device early in the process before the metal goes on, you see something that looks like this, and indeed you see these polysilicon gates. The width of the gate is just right across here, for example, which is now down to on the order of 30 nanometers. And you have the source drains on either side to make an individual transistor. Now, if I go back in some of the history of TI that I'm familiar with, what did we do? What did we work on? And it wasn't only us on some of these things, but we had a number of firsts. I'll illustrate that with a cross-section view. So here's a gate in cross-section, and it would be a source over here and a drain over here. And one of the first things that really impressed me about some of our work at TI was a fellow named Bill Hunter came up with this idea that we could actually use sidewall filaments to do something useful. And so what he did was he deposited an oxide which would have originally run sort of like that, and then he did an anisotropic etch of it. In other words, just reduced it straight down. So when it cleared on the top of the transistor gate and also cleared over here on the drain, if you stop the etch at that point, you're left with a little sidewall residue, what we just call a filament. Now, normally those filaments were no good. Normally we tried to get rid of filaments of things because they meant things would be shorted together. Usually we had filaments in the conductor levels, and we'd try to etch those away. But this was a dielectric filament of oxide, which didn't electrically affect anything, except it could be used as a mask for a source drain implant. And so with this little filament acting as an auxiliary mask alongside the gate, you could force the source drain implant to start over here, and then when you out-diffused it to activate the arsenic or phosphorus or boron, whatever it was, then it could diffuse over under here and give you a transistor that had much less overlap of this gate structure and the source drain. That reduced a parasitic capacitance that the device would have otherwise had and really made a big improvement in terms of the performance. Several other things here. I was involved in something that we didn't actually go to production with because it was of the conflict with the next thing. And it was a refractory metal gate. So we had used polysilicon for the gates of transistors. And I was working on using molybdenum gates. And we probably would have gone to production with that back in the early 80s, except for the fact that the design guys also wanted us to have a silicide over the active area. They wanted to reduce the resistance of the active area even more than they did the resistance of the gate. And it turned out it was very difficult to get good yield and make those two processes compatible. So we made the decision to go with the silicide, which could also be done on top of the polysilicon. So you did reduce the resistance of the gate some, just not quite as much as if you had used a solid metal gate. So that's one of these kinds of trade-offs that happen. Then there was work done on dielectrics. Paul Horn talked about this a little bit earlier, but you know what separates this gate from the single crystal silicon is a very thin layer of dielectric, originally silicon dioxide, and nitrogen began to be added to the silicon dioxide back in the late 80s, actually, and early 90s, and a particularly effective way to do that using a plasma nitridation process was developed by George Amisium, who worked for me earlier, but later came up with this process in the later 90s. Another fellow who still works for me now, Luigi Colombo, was one of a number of pioneers in the industry who were working on this problem of the high K-gate dielectric. You know, how do we get a really high capacitance material in here, even much more so than the plasma nitride oxide, which is a little higher dielectric constant than the silicon dioxide, and came up with this idea, or Luigi's contribution here really, was the idea of, okay, we don't need to think of this so much as just being a totally different kind of oxide. People were talking about using zirconium oxide or aluminum oxide or something. But the problem with that is you tended to get interfaces that weren't quite as good as the good old silicon dioxide to silicon interface that we were used to. So you might get charge traps at that interface or whatever, which would give you erratic device characteristics. Luigi said, let's look at it differently. Let's see if we can still keep that interface to be silicon dioxide to silicon, essentially, but just add some metal in, and maybe not even have it so much right at the interface, but segregate up away from the interface a little bit. And so it was a different way of looking at the problem, and now the industry is just on the verge of using hafnium silicate in various mixtures as the actual high K gate material, the first one. Really significantly different than silicon dioxide. And this slide just shows sort of a evolution of that as we went from silicon dioxide through the P&O and up to the hafnium silicate. One of the difficult things to do, of course, is control these layers in terms of the individual stoichiometry that I just mentioned. And so this shows for P&O, much less the hafnium silicate, you know, you'd like to have a lot of silicon dioxide right at that interface, and then it turned out we had an auxiliary peak, and then the nitrogen has a different shape to it. And so controlling that kind of a profile, even in a relatively thick gate like this, was one of the many challenges that people at TI and other companies worked on. one of the most fun projects that I worked on at TI back in the 80s was making the first vertical MOSFETs. So what we actually did was we made some trenches down into the silicon, and this was really a project to make a 4 megabit DRAM. And so we had to have a source for these transistors at the surface, a gate that went down into the silicon, and then a drain that was actually buried underneath of it. And it was a lot of fun trying to figure out how to make this buried drain, you know, not by lithographic processes, but by clever depositions and etches and underfills and all kinds of things so that we could make that kind of device. So we have a vertical transistor here that actually has a cylindrical gate and then underneath of it a capacitor to make that 1T type DRAM cell that Paul Horn talked about earlier. That was Bob Dennard's invention. Somebody in our lab had they always like to make cute SEMs. And so they took that 4 megabit DRAM based on that and splattered some frog neurons on it and took a picture just to show that, wow, at this point in time, we had scaled to the level where we had about 2 micrometer pitch metal. And, you know, that's getting pretty small compared to some biological computing mechanisms. Okay, then we did more work on three-dimensional transistors much more recently than that. This is a so-called FinFET or multiple gate device. which is also a vertical gate, and you're trying to get more surface area for the transistor itself without using more area of the silicon. And so this three-dimensional phenomenon is coming in a big way now in packaging as well as in the silicon, and it's one of the big pushes these days. Okay, so now I'm going to jump back in time again and look at the history of some process development at TI. So we had a lab that was part of our central research lab back in the 80s, and a fellow named Graydon Larrabee worked on ultra-high vacuum processing and characterization. So he had a setup that looked very much like what you'd find in a lot of physics labs, and we did this sort of work back then. One of the things that it led to was a project that was jointly sponsored by DARPA and the Air Force that I was the director of, called Microelectronics Manufacturing Science and Technology. And we were really in that project trying to revolutionize a number of things about the manufacturing of integrated circuits. And we had all these homemade machines here, and I'll go into a little detail about one little piece of that. Before we did the work on MMST, on what's called rapid thermal processing, thermally driven processing, whether it was diffusions or annealing or oxide growth, was all done in these giant furnace tubes. So you can see in this case here, there's an open end of a tube that's maybe at 1,000 degrees or something like that. And here's a stack of wafers about to be pushed in there. And so this is really an equilibrium process. You've got to push those wafers in very slowly, let them go from room temperature up to 1,000 degrees and make sure they don't turn into potato chips with all kind of dislocations as you push them in. And so this is a very slow process. It will do a lot of wafers at once, but there are control problems. There are always differences in the characteristics of the wafers on the end from the center and various things. So a fellow that we just hired from Stanford named Mehrdad Moslehi had this idea of using multi-zone lamps. So what you're looking at here is up into the business end of a lamp housing that has a bunch of lamps that are each a couple of kilowatts. And when this flops down, and I think I have a picture of that on the next slide, over the silicon wafer, and you turn this on, you've got somewhere between 50 and 100 kilowatts of radiant energy going onto that silicon wafer. You can heat it up very rapidly. And so this is a non-equilibrium thermal process, what we call a rapid thermal process, where in just a minute or two, you could do your anneal, do your oxidation, whatever you were going to do, rather than having to do it in the equilibrium, quasi-equilibrium fashion in the furnace tube. And so here's a lamp where the wafer would be down here. Here's the lamp shining down on it. And here is one of the resulting wafers that we got out of this program back in 1993. That was the first set of integrated circuits ever fabricated that was entirely with single wafer processing, no batch processing. It was also, all of the thermal processing was rapid thermal, and there was also no wet processing used. We used absolutely no wet chemical baths for anything, and that was also a first. So three things done uniquely here to produce wafers like that. Of the three, the one that's been the biggest commercial success is the rapid thermal processing. That is used very widely for all of the really critical thermal processing steps today. Single wafer, we've probably gone from, commercially back then, about half the processes were single wafer. Today, they're about 85, 90% single wafer. And so we had a big influence there. And there's still some wet processing, but this really pioneered a lot of the move towards dry. Now, another one that's a favorite of mine, because my background is really nuclear physics, another friend of mine, Rob Bauman, discovered the answer to a problem that had been plaguing us for soft errors on integrated circuits. We knew that alpha particles in the materials that made up the circuit could cause soft errors. So just the particles causing ionization in the silicon would short junctions out and make circuits fail. And so that was something that was well understood. What we didn't understand was when we took all of the alpha particles out of the materials that we made the integrated circuits with, you know, all of the alpha emitters, we still had problems. And so Rob figured out what the deal was. It was that the high-energy proton flux that was coming into the top of the atmosphere actually wound up producing enough thermalized neutrons by the time you got down here to good old Mother Earth that these were fissioning the, or not fissioning, but, well, you could you could essentially say fissioning, yeah. Boron tin nuclei that were in the boron in our circuits. And we had boron used for several different things in integrated circuits. And the fact that naturally occurring boron is both boron 11 and boron 10 with enough boron 10 in it to give us this reaction mechanism. And those recoils were actually the problem. So Rob worked on ways of getting around that, replacing the some of the boron-containing materials. And, you know, that was a very nice piece of work that solved a problem that we had. So I'm going to go a little pretty quickly now because I don't have much time left. We had this quantum electronics program at TI during the 1990s. I think the most significant thing that came out of it was some very nice work on modeling transport in semiconductors. Gerhard Klimek, who's now at Purdue, Chris Bowen, who's still at TI, and Roger Lake worked on this program called NEMO. And this was actually, this might have been even a CIA contract originally. But anyway, they applied non-equilibrium Green function transport theory for the first time to semiconductors. And they were really interested in studying resonant tunneling diodes, and in particular explaining what the peak-to-valley ratio was in the IV characteristic of the diode. And they were much more successful using this technique than anything before, a real brute force sort of tour de force. And today you can use the successor to that work. Gerhard at Purdue has continued working on it, turning NEMO into what he now calls OMEN, and that is something that's available online from the Purdue NanoHub and can be used by any of you who are interested in doing that kind of calculations. So in summary, you know, we spent about five decades now scaling Jack Kilby's invention of the integrated circuit. This shows the decrease in minimum feature sizes, which, as Paul said, has been many orders of magnitude. The nice correlation we have with the global integrated circuit sales shows that that's certainly been a good thing for the industry. We're up to, he was showing $100 billion, but today it's actually over a quarter of a trillion dollars in revenue for the semiconductor industry. And that's nice, and we continue to do that, as Paul said. The most recent thing that's different, though, is there is more of an emphasis now on going back to adding new functions to integrated circuits, not just making things smaller. So we'll continue to do both for a while. Even if we run out of steam along this axis, which we call more after Gordon Moore, we will continue to work on this other axis, which we lightheartedly call more than more, which is further functional diversification. And so I'll give you a couple examples of that at TI. One is the work that we've done in the last decade on really dense embedded ferroelectric memory. In fact, we partnered some with I guess it was it HP or was it already Agilent?
It spanned across the HP Agilent.
Okay, it spanned that border of that transition. And also with a company called Ramtron, who was doing basically low density ferroelectric memory earlier. And this is something where you're adding a new kind of non-volatile memory, which at least for embedded memory will be easier for us to integrate than flash. So the first products are just now coming out with this. Instead of having to add many, many mask steps, which we would need to do a flash process, we can do this with just a couple of extra masks. So the last example that I'll show you in the spirit of this more than more is another long-term thing that is kind of amazing. The industrial lab had the patience to pursue for all these years. But a physicist at TI, who's still there, Larry Hornbeck, back in 1978 had this idea of making digital micro mirrors, and just using, so you see some here in the SEM, cartoon schematic here shows there's parts underneath of these things, but basically they're just suspended aluminum plates that are isolated from each other but connected underneath to a mechanical spring of one sort or another, and also underneath have electrodes where electrostatically you can deflect the plate. And it's actually much more complicated than that. Most people, even inside TI, would just think, oh, we just put a voltage here and it pulls the plate down this way, or a voltage over here to flip it the other way. It's much more complicated than that in terms of how these things are launched. But this actually won the most recent, the 2007-2008 AIP Prize for Industrial Applications of Physics. And a few years earlier than that, Larry also won an Emmy. But I'll guarantee you he's more proud of the AIP Prize than he is of the Emmy. So thanks very much.
We have time for one or two more questions.
I'm curious to see how much or what fraction of your research is beyond the next generation, say 5 years and maybe 10 years. Do you have people doing those things?
Okay, so very good question. how much of our research is out beyond the next 5 to 10 year kind of time frame? Well, one way to look at that is, the way the accountants look at our total R&D budget, for TI, it's about $2 billion a year, which is something like 14% of revenue. And so that's a large amount and a large fraction of revenue. It's typical in our industry to have more than 10%. In petrochemicals or something, you might see 1%. So a very, very big difference. But most of that is product development. There's no question of that. But we spend between $50 and $100 million a year on research, most of which is external. Some of it's internal, but I'll just give you the bigger number, because increasingly more of it is in partnership with other companies through consortia. And some of those consortia are doing things in kind of maybe the 5 to 7 year time frame that's really aimed at maybe a couple of product generations from now. But an awful lot of it, increasing amount of it, is actually research being done at universities, but that is sponsored by the consortium. And so really that's where a lot of our long range research is being done today. Yes?
How long did it take from concept to industrial production?
Okay, how long did it take from concept to industrial production? Well, one of the fellows that I mentioned in the slide, Graydon Larrabee, actually did a study on that back in the late 80s, and he took about 30 different examples. Some of them were TI examples, but not all of them were. And the average that he came up with was 12 years from, typically that would be from publishing a paper to the point where you had something actually in a product that was being sold to a customer. I've seen other studies that people have done. Somebody, Ralph Cavan, did one at the SRC a few years ago. I think he got even a little longer time frame, maybe 15 years. And so it tends to be a relatively long time if you use those endpoints as the measure of concept to production.
Any further questions?
What if approaches to move beyond CMOS don't turn out to be successful? What will happen?
Well, okay, so the question is, what if the approaches to beyond CMOS don't turn out to be successful? What will we do? Well, of course, we'll continue with the very best CMOS that we can possibly make. We will hopefully continue to figure out ways to reduce the cost of it. Even if we can't make it smaller, which has been reducing the cost and also typically making it faster and less power. We have some ideas on further reducing the power, maybe not increasing speed, but at least decreasing the power usage as well as decreasing the cost that don't depend on further miniaturization. So those ideas will be definitely pursued very heavily. And of course, the other thing is, it was sort of my last major point, was that we will continue to add new kinds of functionality, whether it be MEMS or fluid microfluidics or whatever it might be on chip to whatever kind of integration level we can, basically to make systems that are superior to what you could make without that level of integration before.
Well, if anybody has a question that will take 1 minute to answer, then there's time. Well, then let's thank